This is Civil Defense Radio with your host, Preston Schleinkofer. Today we have author and military veteran, Michael Mabee, the author of the Civil Defense book. How you doing, Michael?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Preston.
Yes, it's a pleasure. You know, just for full disclosure, Michael and I have known each other for a while. We've actually got to meet once, that was last December at the InfraGuard EMP SIG conference. Now, is that what they call it?
Yeah. The EMP SIG conference.
Yeah. So, I read your book quite a while ago. I read your first book, and then I read your updated, which you changed the title to the Civil Defense book, which I thought was golden. That change, I think, really made a big difference in targeting the audience.
Yeah, I think I think it did. I mean, the initial book was prepping for a suburban or rural community, which is basically what this is about. But really, when I thought about it, what that means is civil defense. And I know you've kind of coined the term continuity of community, but we have not had civil defense in this country now for quite a while, and many of us, including us too,
yeah,
this needs to return, and return quickly to the U.S. So I'm really, really excited to be able to talk tonight about this.
Well, Michael, I thank you for your friendship, and a lot of people don't know it, but your blog was a first opportunity for me to become public in this sphere of civil defense when I published the two pieces for my civil defense guide, a new American civil defense structure. And so those two blog posts eventually morphed into my complete guide. And it was your website and blog that gave me the opportunity to form that and get it out there. So I thank you very much.
Oh, no problem. And we've got a couple places in the country, and Virginia is one of them, where there's exciting things going on right now, in trying to build a culture of preparedness. So actually, that's probably a good place to start, if you'd like. We just had a report come out from FEMA, very, very interestingly. This report came out in January of this year, and it was called Building Cultures of Preparedness Report for the Emergency Management Higher Education Community. It's a FEMA report. And when this was reported in Emergency Management Magazine, the headline was, "Report, We've Failed Miserably at Preparedness." And, this is kind of something that, both you and I have been trying to fix, now for some time, is the fact that we don't have a culture of preparedness in the United States. That actually is a national security concern. And one of the reasons that an adversary might wish to target our electric grid, whether it's through a cyber attack, a physical attack, an electromagnetic pulse, one thing that makes us a fat, juicy target is the fact that everybody knows that we are unprepared to lose the power grid nationally for any period of time. The Russians know it, the Chinese know it, the North Koreans know it, the Iranians know it. We're just starting to realize it. FEMA admitted, last year, almost exactly a year ago, that there is no plan for a national scale power outage right now. So, let's kind of backtrack to civil defense and, kind of the role that played and then what we lost when it went away. And I think that might be kind of an interesting, way to start this conversation. So, we used to worry about a nuclear war when it was, the United States and Russia, and in, the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Right.
The big concern was, a nuclear war. And we actually did have a plan. Now, you can argue, how viable it was, But, you know, we had shelters. We were stockpiling food and water. We had equipment. We had a civil defense mechanism in place. And people knew what to do. I remember when I was in elementary school, embarrassed to say, in the late 60s and early 70s, we used to have the duck and cover drills.
Yes, I remember those also.
Yep. They called them tornado drills for us in Ohio, and we did have tornadoes, but, you know, they were, you know, thinly veiled civil defense drills. Now, let's fast forward to now. Last year, as you recall, almost a year ago, there was a false ballistic missile launch alert in Hawaii.
Yes.
So everybody in Hawaii got this text message that said, you know, incoming ballistic missiles, this is not a drill. And as it turns out, it was a false alarm. But one of the things that really, really bothered me the most about it was the press was interviewing some guy on the street about this false alarm, and his comment was nobody knew what to do. So, you know, people got this alert and nobody knew what to do. So, you know, we've gotten so far away from a culture of preparedness in this country. And really, when civil defense morphed into emergency management, you know, kind of at the end of the Cold War, and when we weren't really worried about nuclear Armageddon anymore, what we kind of lost, or not kind of lost, what we specifically lost was the training and involvement of our communities.
Yes.
So emergency management basically became a function of emergency managers. And you do have CERT teams and Medical Reserve Corps, and you've got, ARES, the ham radio operator. So, you know, there is some degree of citizen involvement, but not anywhere to the extent that it needs to be.
It's such a minute piece that it's not even measurable, really.
Well, exactly. And moreover, take, for example, CERT. I've been involved in CERT for several years. And most people who join a CERT team, which is a community emergency response team, kind of the focus is on that response piece.
Right.
So, you know, they train to be able to do, you know, search and rescue if a child's lost in the woods, or, you know, be able to, you know, direct traffic at a accident if more manpower is needed, or, you know, if there's an earthquake or a tornado, they can respond to light search and rescue, first aid, triage, you know, mass casualties. So, you know, they're trained in doing that type of response. But nobody right now has the mission of emergency preparedness when you think about it. So
well,
the police chief doesn't have it. The fire
right.
department doesn't have it. And, you know, most emergency managers, they're focusing on kind of the emergency management piece, but not necessarily getting into the living rooms of the town residents to see whether they're, you know, prepared and whether they have non-perishable goods and water and, you know how to purify water if they had to.
Right. Well, the CERT team, the CERT team is not a real entry level program either. It's a little more advanced. There's, you know, you got to be first aid certified, and everybody should have somebody in the household that's certified in first aid. Most adults should be. It takes a little bit more of a commitment to do that. Whereas just being prepared through some basic civil defense training is not as involved, I don't believe, as CERT is.
Yeah, that's very true. So, you know, to get the CERT training is actually, you know, it's a 40-hour course. Covering, you know, light search and rescue, first aid, fire suppression, you know, just, you know, the basic things that the CERT people need to know. But you're absolutely right. You know, that isn't something that necessarily is going to attract everybody in the community. Not everybody in the community wants to join a CERT team. But what we do know is everybody in the community needs to be thinking about emergency preparedness. So how do we do that? You know, how do we reach the people in the community? And what this new FEMA report said is that, you know, what FEMA's been doing over the last couple years to try to engage the community has been, quote, you know, we've failed miserably at preparedness.
Right.
Unquote. And so building a culture of preparedness isn't something that you can do from a building in Washington, D.C. So, and I think FEMA knows this. You know, it's, you can't build a culture of preparedness, you know, from Washington, D.C. It's got to be done in the living rooms in our community.
Yes, the homes and neighborhoods and communities. That's where it needs to be built. There's a graphic from the 50s that shows exactly how civil defense should be structured. And it starts out with the individual and families and neighborhoods and communities, and then it expands from there. But it's ever since we had a shift in our nuclear strategy from force on force with the Soviets to mutually assured destruction, our civil defense started waning, and the idea of emergency management started to grow. And that's where the two switched. And so they became managers of emergencies rather than preparing citizenry for their own protection and survival.
Right. And there is a fundamental... Now, our emergency management system has served us very well.
Yes.
In disasters large and small. So, you know, I want to say that. And, you know, I have nothing but admiration for the emergency managers in America, you know, who have... kept us safe in all these disasters. But there is one fatal flaw in our emergency management system, and that is that it depends on outside resources.
Yes.
So, for those unfamiliar with emergency management, you know, with kind of our system in general, so take, for example, a town, and they have enough resources in their police and their fire department for a blue sky day and, you know, to handle most type of incidents. But if you have something that overwhelms the local capabilities, let's say, you know, a huge, you know, structure fire requiring more personnel and equipment, they call for mutual aid. If you have something that's even bigger that overwhelms even that, so let's say a tornado or, you know, hurricane or something like that, then you can expand out further and you can call for aid from the state and from the federal government. Now, in the United States, we have never had a national-scale catastrophe, and a lot of people don't realize that, but when you look at, like, for example, Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Maria, which were horrible disasters, but they were regional in scale.
Right.
They were isolated to a particular area of the United States, the air quote, disaster area, and then outside the disaster area, everything was fine. So we could bring in massive resources, you know, into New Orleans for Katrina, into Puerto Rico for Maria, you know, from elsewhere in the United States, we could bring in all these massive resources, and these disasters were still this bad, you know, even despite the massive resources. So now, what would happen if there was a national-scale disaster? So there are 35,000 towns and cities in the United States. And, you know, right now, in every single one of these, you know, 35,000 towns and cities in the United States, there's an emergency manager. There's somebody that's, you know, kind of in charge of this. And their initial thought when things go south is going to be to go into their emergency operations center and call for help and get outside resources.
Yes.
But what if substantially all of our 35,000 towns and cities in the United States were the disaster area? And specifically, I'm talking about, you know, a long-term national-scale loss of our electric grid, which could happen for a variety of reasons. But, you know, once the entire United States becomes, you know, kind of a disaster area, there's nowhere to bring outside resources from. So then at that point, your town is on your own. Survival is a local issue. That's where we have failed. You know, we depend on outside resources. And the former FEMA Administrator Brock Long, you know, even said this, that, you know, at the local level, we have got to be the first responders and we have to be prepared to be without help for a long period of time. Brock Long, you know, he knew that this was the case and that this was what we needed. We needed a culture of preparedness in the United States.
Yes.
which, you know, presently we don't have. That's what civil defense, in my view, brings to the table, is the ability on the local level to reach people, you know, because we're using local people who know all of the organizations, the businesses, the people, the faith-based organizations, you know, they have all of this knowledge, and also they have knowledge of what the needs of the communities are. So, you know, for example, up here in New Hampshire, we have different issues and different problems than they would have in the desert southwest of the United States. You know, for example, water sources are not going to be as big of a problem for us up here as they would be for some other communities. You know, up here in New Hampshire, if a cyber attack took out the electric grid in January, you immediately have a humanitarian disaster because, you know, you've got a lot of people who would die of exposure, due to the loss of electricity. So, you know, every community, there isn't a one-size-fits-all. Every community's got to kind of figure out, you know, what they would need to do to prepare.
And how do they do that? How would they do that, Michael?
So we know what the problems would be. And a matter of fact, there are plenty of the 20 years worth of reports and hearings out there. We know what will happen when the grid goes down. So, for example, we know food is going to stop coming in. We know that water is going to stop, whether you have well water or whether you have city water. Once the backup generators run out of fuel, you know, you're out of water. Sewer's going to stop. Transportation's going to stop. Communication's going to stop. The medical system's going to collapse, and we've seen this before. For example, Hurricane Katrina is a great example of the medical system collapsing, you know, when the grid goes down. So we know what the problems are going to be. You know, people are going to start getting sick from waterborne diseases because, you know, they don't have clean water sources, and they don't know how to purify water anymore.
Right.
You know, people are going to start to starve because no more food's going to be coming to the grocery store. We all see the pictures of the grocery store before the hurricane hits, right? Wiped out.
Yeah.
So our grocery stores generally only have, you know, a couple days worth of food there. And, you know, once that's gone, it's gone and no more food is coming in. So we're literally only a few meals away from starvation in our communities. But, you know, really because we've become so dependent on the electric grid. Matter of fact, dependent isn't even really the right word. We're literally on life support plugged into this electric grid. Everything that makes it possible for 326 million people to exist in the United States is completely dependent on the electric grid. Food, water, just our shelter, for example. You know, up here in New Hampshire, 10 degrees outside, and if the electric grid goes down, you don't have any heat in your house. You can't cook. You can't, no matter what fuel you have for your furnace, it doesn't work. Hopefully you got a wood stove and a couple cords of wood in the back, but a lot
of but how many places have that? Not many.
Exactly.
Not modern communities. No way.
And we don't really think about that anymore. So it used to be that we thought about making it through the winter. You know, you had to store food down in your root cellar, and you had to, you know, chop wood and have enough wood to make it through the winter. We actually had to worry about survival. Now, you know, really with the advent of the electric grid and all of the modern conveniences it brings, none of us really have to worry about surviving the winter, and most people don't worry about that at all. If you get hungry, you go to the store and buy food, or you go to Taco Bell, or you order takeout. You know, if you want water, you turn on the tap, and water comes out. You know, most people don't think about what the ramifications would be of a loss of electric grid. So back to your question, what can communities do? We know what the problems will be, so we have to come up with solutions. And I'll give you a great example. In third world countries, one of the things that kills people is waterborne diseases. Now, the United States without an electric grid is going to be a third world country. And very, very quickly, we're going to find that people are going to start getting sick and dying, you know, by the tens of thousands and then the hundreds of thousands and then the millions of waterborne diseases.
How I describe that is going back to Little House on the Prairie overnight.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And so, you know, we've got several problems, one of which is we're so used to potable water in any quantity we want coming out of our tap that we wouldn't know what to do for the most part, you know, unless you're, you know, kind of a hardcore, prepper. You don't really know what to do, or you don't really have a plan if all of a sudden you turn on the tap and that stops. So now what people are going to do is they're going to start using unsafe water sources. They're going to start going to the pond or the stream or the river to get water. And if they don't know how to purify it, they start to come down with waterborne diseases. Moreover, because we lose our sewer systems, we lose our septic systems because you need water to flush the toilet.
Right.
The field sanitation piece is going to start contaminating even more water, exacerbating the whole problem of waterborne diseases. Further, moreover, if there are factories upriver from where you are, what is the effect of the loss of the grid going to be on those? Is there going to be further contamination of these water sources you're depending on? So now,
nuclear power plants as well.
Yeah, your community can think ahead of time about these problems, and the water part is in a lot of areas not hard to solve. The EPA has a great fact sheet on purification of water. You can get it up on my website, www.civildefensebook.com, or from the EPA. Just Google EPA water purification fact sheet. And if we could get that fact sheet into every house in America, just a copy of that one piece of paper, it would save hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of lives if our grid went down and people actually knew how to purify water. And if a community thinks about this ahead of time, just by storing some simple and inexpensive supplies, they can prevent a lot of waterborne diseases. You know, for relatively little cost, a little bit of training of your citizenry, and you don't even have to have everybody. If we train enough people, if heaven forbid there is a long-term power outage, neighbors can help neighbors if they know what to do. You know, if we've got enough people trained, they're going to help other people out, as far as teaching them how to purify water. But the waterborne disease piece is one of the ones that a community really, really can make major strides towards mitigating that terrible loss of life that would occur. You know, another one is food. So, you know, we know that the food stops coming into the store. So are we teaching our people to store non-perishable goods, you know, at home and, you know, insufficient quantities, you know, to be able to survive a power outage? So, you know, the FEMA emergency preparedness checklist, which, by the way, I'm a big fan of. I love that checklist because I think it covers just about everything. But, you know, it tells you to have enough food and water for 72 hours. Now, I've personally been through a power blackout of 11 days. So obviously 72 hours, you know, to me isn't going to cut it. And I've also seen in Puerto Rico, we saw that people were without power and potable water for months.
Yes.
So we know it's possible. We know it's possible.
Well, the West Coast.
We could be without water and food for, you know, weeks or months.
Yes.
So we need to start teaching our people this and getting them to think about stocking up their pantries with non-perishable goods just in case.
Yes. On the West Coast, it seems like Oregon, Washington, and California, all three of them are going to 14-day supply, being prepared, because they've realized that if they have a mega earthquake, then they're going to be hard-pressed to get to everybody and help them out within 72 hours. So they're saying go for 14 days, and that's a good starting point. But if the whole nation had a 30-day supply of food, water, and the ability to cook and go to the bathroom and take care of all that stuff, which, you know, it just takes a little imagination on what you're going to need and a little bit of research, and you you can be ready for 30 days without a whole lot of trouble. And it the cost, if it's borne out over a few weeks or a few months, then it's a lot more manageable.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also, when you think about the bigger picture too, so we want to get our communities prepared, we want to get our the individual families on our streets prepared, have more food and water, have some knowledge on how to purify water. But also the bigger thing is, if we had a culture of preparedness in the United States where it wouldn't be such a horrific disaster for us to lose the grid, for 3 or 4 weeks or 6 weeks, where we would have, tens of thousands of people dying of societal collapse and waterborne disease. If we were more prepared, it makes us less of a juicy target. So, right now, the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, and the North Koreans all think about taking out the U.S. electric grid. If they have to fight us, that's the way they want to do it. All of them are aware of the phenomena of electromagnetic pulse, which is one way to do it. And for any listeners who aren't familiar with this, it's similar to a solar flare, which probably a lot of people have heard of those before. But if you explode a nuclear bomb 400 kilometers or higher above the United States, it creates a charge of energy which is carried on the electrical transmission wires and fries the extra high voltage transformers. So, when you're driving down the street, you see that chain link fence and all the electrical stuff behind it and all of the electrical lines going into it. That's a high voltage transformer. Now, these transformers aren't even made in the United States anymore. They're made in Germany and they're made in South Korea. So the normal lead time to replace one of these is 18 months, a year to 18 months on a normal blue sky day. It would take that. If you fry enough of those, like, i.e. with an electromagnetic pulse or even a solar flare, the sun can do this. Humans don't even need to be involved. The sun can do this to us. You take out enough of those transformers, and it is going to be a long, long time before you can bring the electric grid back up. Now, speaking of these transformers, so you're going up the street and you see this transformer and it's behind this really, really strong chain link fence. So it's guarded by a chain link fence and some crossed fingers. There usually aren't even any people at these substations. So they're also vulnerable to things like physical attack. And we actually have seen that out in Metcalf, California, a couple of years ago. We had actually a physical attack against one of these transformers. So we know terrorists can be very sophisticated. I mean, how sophisticated do you have to be to hijack four planes simultaneously and run them into buildings?
Yeah.
So we know that our adversaries are patient. We know they are sophisticated. And, they will stop at nothing to hurt us. Now, these transformers are what I would call a soft target. So, you take out enough of these transformers and it can cause a cascading failure, of parts of the electric grid.
Yeah.
So there are all kinds of threats to the electric grid. And people don't really think about this. When people think of a power outage, they think, the power's out for a couple hours, maybe a couple days at most. We'll bring in utility trucks from Illinois and somebody will save us.
Well,
unfortunately, if it's the whole country, who's going to save us?
Right, right. Well, going back to solar storms, in July of 2012, we had a very strong solar storm that missed us by a week. 1 week, if the rotation of the sun would have and the Earth would have aligned 1 week sooner, we would have had more than a catastrophic failure. It probably would have affected most of the northern hemisphere of the globe.
Right. And let's talk about solar storms for a minute, because, a lot of people don't realize that, how lucky we were a couple years ago, and also how it's a mathematical certainty that the Earth is going to get hit with a big solar storm at some point.
Well, we get hit by them all the time. They're just real small.
Yep. Yeah, they're generally small. So the last time we had a really, really big one was in 1859. It was known as the Carrington event. And back in 1859, we didn't have an electric grid. What we had was telegraphs. And the solar storm sent a charge of energy that was so intense that it charged the telegraph lines, set the telegraph equipment at the stations on fire, and shocked the telegraph operators. So that was without an electric grid. If a solar storm of that magnitude hit the Earth today, it would fry these high-voltage transformers. And, you know, literally, if you fry enough of these, like I said, you can't replace these instantly, and we don't have big stockpiles of extra transformers. As a matter of fact, most of these are site-specific. You know, they have to be manufactured one at a time. You know, you take out enough of those, the power goes out for a long, long period of time. And the longer the power's out, the harder it is to get it back up and running. So now, we did have, you know, many people may not remember this, but in 1989, the province of Quebec's electric grid was taken out by a solar storm.
And this
solar storm was relatively small, you know, compared to the Carrington event. And by the way, solar storms of that magnitude of the 1859 storm happen every 100 to 150 years. So 1859, 2019, do the math,
we're due.
And, you know, it's a mathematical certainty that that is going to happen again. We just don't know when. It could be, you know, a month from now. It could be 10 years from now. We don't know when it's going to happen, but we just know that every 100 to 150 years, the Earth gets hit with a major solar flare. And since we've had this, you know, electric grid, we haven't had one of that scale. Now, the one in Quebec, interestingly enough, actually damaged, so it took out the province of Quebec. It damaged some equipment up there, but it actually also damaged equipment in the United States.
Because they're connected, right? The grids are connected somehow?
Yes. Yeah, the grids are connected. And so, for example, there was a transformer that was damaged in Salem, New Jersey from the solar storm in Quebec. Now, you know, our grid operators did a great job of, you know, keeping the lights on during that solar storm. There were over 100 grid-related emergencies in the United States, but we didn't lose our grid from that. But it's a cautionary tale that, you know, a larger solar storm would cause much more widespread damage.
So
between, you know, like a solar storm and EMP, and let's talk about cyber for a minute, because a lot of people probably, if anything, out of all these threats we're talking about, probably cyber attack is something everybody's heard in the news.
Before we do that, would you address the notion that I've heard a number of times in discussion groups and stuff about, you know, why are you always talking about EMP and you know, this grid stuff? You're wasting too much time talking about that, and it's not something you got to worry about. It's all conspiracy theory or something like that. Can you address that?
Oh, absolutely. So we have got 2 decades of congressional hearings and federal reports talking about these threats to the electric grid. These threats are real. They're not conspiracy theory. I've got a collection up on my website of as many of these as I could find. And I, you know, invite you, if you're skeptical at all about the threats to the electric grid, go up to my website, look under government documents, EMP and grid security, and you will see 2 decades of federal reports, Senate hearings, studies, EMP commission reports. These threats are real. To the electric grid.
They're very real, and I'll tell you, I've printed out your list, and it's 11 pages, and it's not large type. It's very small type, and 11 pages worth of links to various documents and videos and hearing information. It's the most extensive list of government action, which resulted in no action, that I've ever seen.
Yeah, and that raises an interesting question. So people would, you know, say, well, this can't be true because if it was, they, air quote, would do something about it.
Exactly.
They, I assume, being the government. So although we have studied this problem for two decades and the government is very well aware of it, we have, by and large, failed to establish legislation that protects the electric grid. Now, why could that be? Let me give you a couple of numbers that could possibly shed some light on this. So the electric utility industry in 2018 spent $120,725,000 on lobbying. They made almost $12 million in political contributions to members of the House. They made $3,600,000 in political contributions to members of the Senate. And they made total contributions of $24 million, almost $25 million, including soft money and PACs. So the electric utility industry has lobbied very, very hard to prevent further regulation of the electric grid. The electric grid is self-regulated, and the electric utility industry wants it to remain self-regulated. They don't want Congress to come in. So even though we have these hearings and these threats are identified, for some reason, Congress has not stood up and passed legislation to protect the electric grid. Do all these political contributions and lobbying money have anything to do with it? You know, you can make your own judgment on that.
Yeah.
But the electric utility industry, what I can tell you from my experience, fights vehemently when you try to do things to bring increased protections to the electric grid. And specifically, I've seen this in the realm of cybersecurity, and we've also seen this in the realm of EMP and geomagnetic disturbance or solar flares.
Yes.
What the electric utility industry will typically do is say, well, we don't know enough about it. We need to study it more. I call this admiring the problem.
Yeah.
So we've got two decades worth of studies and reports, and we know quite a bit about it. We've known about electromagnetic pulse since 1962. But the electric utility industry, they want to continue to study it, you know, which is basically a recipe for inaction. So they don't want to take any action now. Let's do another study that's going to take 5 years, and then, you know, when that study comes out, the recommendations are going to be, we need to study this problem even more.
Yeah.
So they're delaying and delaying and delaying protecting the electric grid. And because it's self-regulated, they've been able to get away with it. So let's maybe it might not be a bad idea to talk about what the electric grid is. So, you know, a lot of everybody's heard the term electric grid before, but, you know, a lot of people don't really know what that means. So the electric grid is not one thing. And it's not owned by, you know, one company or owned by the government. The electric grid is actually over 1,000, closer to 2,000 different companies, public sector and private sector companies, that are involved in generation, transmission, and distribution of electric power. So the grid is around 2,000 different entities. Nobody owns the whole thing. You know, all these 2,000 different entities own a little piece of it. And so basically, you've got 2,000 barn doors, because since there's no real requirement that they protect themselves against all of these hazards, we rely on these 2,000 companies to just voluntarily do the right thing. That makes me very uncomfortable. You know, there are some companies out there that I think do want to do the right thing. But, you know, by and large, the industry as a whole has fought us on trying to protect the grid from cyber threats, EMP, and solar storms.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's very important to understand that, you know, this whole industry is, you know, self-regulated. They make their own rules. And the federal government can't just tell them what to do. The federal government just can't tell them to go harden yourselves from cyber attacks.
Well, there's some changes coming up that it seems like the military is taking the lead on that is almost going to require their electric providers to have a certain level of protection, correct?
Yeah, and that actually is kind of, since we can't seem to get our federal government to do anything, what we need to do is we need to get our states to make these requirements, and the military is already doing it. So if you live around a military base, and if the military is successful in telling the local grid operator, you know, you've got to be hardened against certain hazards, then obviously you'll benefit from that. But at a state level, we need to talk to our state legislatures about, you know, requiring that grid operators in your state, if they install new equipment on the grid, that new equipment be hardened, you know, to certain specifications, you know, to protect it from known threats. That's, you know, one thing that we can do on that. And then on the civil defense end, you know, getting back to kind of our original thing, we need to prepare our communities. And as we prepare our communities, people are going to become more aware of these threats, and hopefully they'll become more engaged with their elected officials, saying, you know, why is it that you guys aren't protecting us? You're not doing your job. The first job of the federal government is to provide for the common defense, and you're failing to do that. You know, why should I vote for you? That's a conversation that all of our, you know, citizens need to have with their elected officials.
Yes. And if there's any leaders out there in the community, I'm not talking about political, I'm talking about people who have the ability to build an organization and manage it and bring in other competent leadership. I encourage you to start a civil defense organization. We have the ability in the guide that I wrote. It's at civildefenseradio.com under resources tab. It's right at the top. It's right there and gives you a lot of information, and both myself and Michael would be more than happy to talk with anybody who wants to do that. As a matter of fact, I've got a small community, rural community, that's doing just that. This will be my second one here in Virginia.
That is fantastic. You're really starting to get some interest out there. And, you know, another thing you can do, too, is you can the book that I wrote is specifically on this topic of starting a community-based nonprofit civil defense organization, and it's available, you know, on Amazon, and it's available on Kindle. So if you're looking for a plan, if your town doesn't have a plan, you know, I would offer that there's a plan for you. And then, as Preston said, his civil defense guide, you can download that for free right on his website as well.
Yes, I failed to mention that. It was free. But, Michael, it's been a pleasure, a great pleasure of mine to have my friend on the program and have you share your knowledge and your passion with the listeners and with me, too. Because I always enjoy hearing you, and I always pick up something else. Even though I've read your book a number of times, I've read both of them actually, the first one and then the new one, the updated one, and I highlighted so many things in there. It turned yellow instead of white. So it's a great pleasure having you here, and I hope to have you back again sometime soon.
Very good. Honored to be here, and thanks for having me.
Well, Michael, again, thanks for being on Civil Defense Radio.